first of all, thank you so much for agreeing to do this.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff.
All right, first question, how young are you, and how long have you been a monk and a lama?
Pardon me the question.
How young are you? Your age?
How young were I?
No, are you? How old are you?
Okay. I was born in like 1978, so probably around 35, 36.
Okay. And how long have you been a monk and how long a lama?
Actually, lama means a religious priest or a leader. Being a monk.
Maybe tulku is the question then. How long have you been a monk and how long have you been a tulku?
Tulku is like since I take a birth, I was a tulku.
That's true.
Yes.
But you didn't know that.
I didn't know that. We were like, I was recognized at the age of two, but still we didn't like go for the formal educations and whatever the requirements for a tulku. And a monk, like we call, like especially with the Tibetan Buddhism, when we say monk, we are taking the celibacy vow. So that was only for like 7 years, which I practiced, you know. So after 7 years, I didn't want to continue that.
So when did you first take those vows
or precepts? Around 15 years. I joined at the monastery at the age of 13, but I took that celibacy vow starting from 15.
Okay. Second question is, can you explain how it is determined that someone is a tulku, a reincarnated lama?
So what do you exactly mean by determine?
How does anyone decide? How do they, help me with the words, Todd.
How do they recognize?
Who decides? How do they come up to you or me and say,
oh yes,
you're a tulku?
Because there are like various ways to see it. Either my previous life students or the family members would go when a practitioner dies, you know, pass away. The family member, or if he's a monastic leader or something, they would go approach to a higher like yogi or a practitioner to check where he is born. And through their meditative visualization, and they will check even with the dreams, or they will also use some rituals where they go into the trance, connect with the deities, and then see where a person is born. So there are various ways to check where the tulku is born.
But are there only certain people that can do that?
Actually the higher practitioners, they have the vision to see it.
Now those higher practitioners though, are they monastic or are they lay people too?
Yeah, they can be like a lay practitioner or they can be a monk. Those who have the celibacy and do not have the celibacy, both can do. But it has to be the higher practitioner.
Okay, so who determines who the higher practitioners are?
Actually, when one gets like higher vision, who can see the deities, who can go to the trance, and who has the realization of emptiness, so these are the people. So it's not determined by others, but it is seen in his day-to-day practice, and sometimes he has to reveal it as well.
So could I come to you then and say, I've had that realization now?
One can always say, but it shows in his behavior as well. Or maybe the higher practitioners or the higher gurus will tell that he has realized or not. So they can make out. So it's not all about only claiming through verbally claiming, but it has to be like checked with the higher masters as well, you know.
So is there then like some type of like council then that confirm this, that these are one of the higher level teachers?
No, we don't have any councils like that. Depends on our own areas. Whosoever the great master is, he will check. It's more about transparency and being honest with oneself.
Okay. And can you explain exactly what my question I have here is a lama, but I think a lama just means a monastic and a dhamma teacher, right?
Yeah, something like that.
But a tulku is a reincarnated lama.
Yes.
So explain as simply as you can what that really means. Like, trying to phrase the question correctly. Who is that person on the path? Is it someone that has almost reached enlightenment and they're getting another chance? Yes. Or what exactly is it?
There are two types of tulku to understand that. The reincarnate lama, as we understand that we take birth after rebirth, you know, and there are practitioners who are already enlightened, and for the benefit of sentient being, they take rebirth, you know, in various forms and various places where it is need of the Dharma. And there is another sort of tulku who is continuing his continuous journey to get enlightened, but still he has not accomplished that part, and when his lifespan finishes, he passes away, and then he has to, in order to continue to get enlightened, one takes birth, and that is according to his own merit or karmic cycle. So he's still in the karmic cycle. So there is like non-enlightenment tulku and enlightened tulku. So in other words.
Okay. Is it possible for a lay person to become a me in this life, mm-hmm. never being a monastic, mm-hmm. could it happen that I could be reincarnated as a tulku someday?
Normally, like only a practitioner who passes away and then continues another life in order to continue the practice, these people are known as tulku. Like, everyone takes rebirth, but we don't have that title given to every each person who is taking rebirth. It needs to be like serious practitioner in his previous life, whether it's a lay person or monastic monk, it doesn't matter. But the serious practitioner, when he takes rebirth and continues the journey, then we give that title called tulku.
Okay, so a tulku doesn't mean it was someone that was a monk.
No. Like my previous life,
could be anybody.
My previous life, I was a monk for a long time, like who was practicing the celibacy. But at the end, he became a lay practitioner. And he had a son, and now we have like a grandson, and so on.
Okay. What next question, number four? What differentiates the Dalai Lama from other lamas?
Actually, from the political point of view, he is the political head, and also he is a spiritual head. We have four schools, like four major schools in Tibetan Buddhism. Now, like they have come to understand that there are five major religion, schools, I would say. Like one school was some more like demolished badly over a period of time. So commonly what we say is Nyingma Sakya Kachu Gelug. There are four major schools in Tibetan Buddhism. So in order to have, in order to lead them in a proper way, you know, so they have chosen the Dalai Lama as the spiritual head, you know. So this has been continuing from the fifth Dalai Lama. So Dalai Lama's role is to look and preserve all the school's unique traditions.
Number five, how do you see the difference between some Buddhist philosophy that believes in rebirth rather than reincarnation?
Yeah, rebirth actually means like a common person taking a life. The next life is considered as a rebirth. Whereas reincarnation normally means the person who is already enlightened and who has the capability to take rebirth any place where he want, and he comes only to benefit others. But whereas in the Tokus, actually it is not correct to give the reincarnation Lama. Only to those who are enlightened Lamas could be given that title. But generally speaking, we tend to give this reincarnated Lama. You know, we don't say like rebirth Lama. So it's just a verbal way of saying where we are like used to it. But the real meaning of reincarnation means those who are enlightened and then takes a birth with choice to help the beings. These are reincarnations.
But in some traditions, I believe, rebirth doesn't mean reincarnation in any form.
Yes.
But it means you can be reborn in a different realm.
Yes,
so
yes,
it
of course.
Could be the
of
animal
course.
Realm.
Yes,
could
yes,
be
of course.
The Deva realm.
Yes, yes, same. Like a person with his karmic depth,
right.
He takes a birth. It could be human, it could be non-human, you know, it could be animal, it could be devas. So these are called rebirth. Whereas incarnation is enlightened person, and also this incarnation can also take a form of deva or take a form of animal for very special purpose. The real purpose of incarnation is that he has overcome the ignorance and how he wanted to help the sentient beings, you know.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. Number six. I know that at one time you had disrobed.
Mm-hmm.
What convinced
yes.
you to return to the monastic sangha?
Well, once I was disrobed, there is a cause, because number one is because there was a lot of traditional, how you say, way of defining things to the youngsters. And when I look at the youngsters, they are not happy with the monastic way of defining things, and they don't feel really close with the monks, because the monks and the lay people, they have lots of gap, I would say. So in order to maintain that gap, you know, we have to appear in such way that youngsters would love to see. Not that the monastery would love youngsters to come up, you know. So it is very important that the person who is in the higher stage has to come down and correlate with them. Make more comfortable for them to have more access, you know, of communication and understanding. I was like inspired from the ancient kings of Nepal and also those influential kings back in India, because when I see the history, I found that the kings who are already in a higher post, you know, they come down in disguise so that they can communicate with their own citizens, so they don't have to always go through the officials to see what's going on. He wants to have the direct link with it, you know. So that's the reason. And these were the people, like those who went in disguise and tried to understand his citizen or his people, you know. These were the most influential people in the history. And they could bring out the best for what the citizens really needed, what the country people need. So similarly, I use the same tactic, disrobing myself and being like a lay person and trying to communicate, you know, where they feel more comfortable.
So that was your intention for
yes,
disrobing?
Yes,
then.
Yes,
okay.
Yes, it
so
was.
So then what made you decide to go back in the robes?
Yeah, because there always has a time, you see. So I don't work according to like I have to robe for whole life or I don't have. According to the time and the need of people, it changes, you know. So it is more like sometimes it seems to be like very cunning, but if you like follow the Buddhist method, I think the Mahayana method especially, it's called skillful method, you know. So you change according to the people's mentality, according to the situation, what is needed. So the method is delivered and your appearance changes, you know. So it's more about the flexibility. It's more about open mind rather than conservative and very, how you say, square-headed, I would say, like that. Yeah.
Okay, so you felt it was time then?
Yeah, it was time, yes, of course, okay.
Number seven, what purpose do you see deities or devas serving in the Buddhist practice, and do you think it's important to believe or have faith in those stories?
See, now the devas and deities, we have to differentiate here, because when we're talking about the deities, we are mostly talking about the enlightened deities. And when we are talking about the devas, we are talking about those who are higher than the human quality, those who have superhuman qualities, those who live in the higher realms, but they are still in the samsara. They are not enlightened. So, of course, when we try to do some rituals which can be benefited in the immediate need of life, let's say if I do some farming, maybe I may go to an earth deity or soil deity or water deity, you know. So these are not exactly the enlightened deity, but we can always use the word deity or the devas, but actually they are the devas, you know. Or maybe some of the nagas, you know, the serpents. So it's to worship them and to make them happy, and to approach them is just like approaching to a mayor of a city, you know, like we can't just approach to the president always. So it's more like relating with those people who are very easy accessible. Getting the point?
I am. Yeah. So if that farmer didn't approach those deities, are you saying he couldn't do as good with his farming?
No, it's not like that.
As if he does?
That's one method, you know. That's one way of dealing with it. Let's say if I have a headache, there are 200 plus therapies in this world, you see. Now I can use any of those therapies. I can use acupuncture, I can use yoga, I can use acupressure, I can use antibiotic, you know, like, so there are lots of theories. So it doesn't mean it has to go only in that way, because this is one of a very beautiful tradition, I would say. But there are other ways which can correlate with the science and technology as well, you see. So these are the things, mostly like the devas, or are those who have the superhuman quality but still in the samsara, but people tend to worship them in order to get the immediate need for the life. You see, like the rain, water, fertile soil, and so on. Like the shamans practice, like a lot of shamans also practice the same way. And they have, like, every element has their own god or the devas which helps them. And there is another one who is like the deities, and deities are actually the pure form of enlightened beings. And it can be only seen through the third eye or the awakened mind, you know. And it is not, it cannot be seen through the eyeballs that we have right now. So these are the pure form, and especially as you might have seen a lot of tankas, and we talk about the deities, it is to visualize and inspire from them and try to generate that sort of Buddhahood quality like the deities they have, you know, within oneself. So the deity plays a role to evoke your own pure.
So more as an example, you're saying, not to grant your wishes,
but
to inspire, more, encourage you, cultivate.
Yes, yes. Okay. Actually, the deities especially, the enlightened deities.
Beautiful. Number eight, do you have specific goals for your life and your practice other than enlightenment?
Yes, of course. I have, because for me, like health, wealth, creativity, spirituality, emotion matters, you know. When it comes to the spirituality, of course, the goal of every spiritual practice is to understand yourself and then to get enlightened. But we also do have, like in this lifespan, we also have like goal of achieving better health and creativity, because human always expand their intelligence and creativity. And we are looking for the places where we can appreciate music, where we can appreciate art. So I wanted to make an institution where there is art, music, and so on, you know, where they have the room for the creativity. And also for the health issues like yoga and then the other practices as well. And I have for the wealth program, because unless a person don't have a certain amount of security or a job or something, he cannot survive, you know. And because he need a survival instinct and some work or something like that. So in order to have that, how we tend to live in a proper livelihood, and what sort of job we have to do, how to develop in our own career. So that also matters a lot. So I think these are the fields which I really wanted to develop and make a sort of like a academic sort of things. That's one of my...
So does that mean like you'd like to create some sort of center?
Yes.
Like a physical place where you develop all these things?
Yes. And and also monitor on it.
That's a good goal.
Yes, thank you.
Number 9. Don't you think that the goal of enlightenment is simply another desire? Which Pali, Tanha, and Sanskrit, how do you say that? Trishna?
Trishna, yes. See, it is like this. In the initial period, the desire of being positive doesn't mean the Trishna. Here the meaning of Trishna means having the immense sort of like desire, not only the desire. If you look from the higher above or the highest standard or those who have the higher practice, who have a higher practice, who understood the emptiness, from that level, if you see, that tends to be a Trishna. Because trying to achieve an enlightenment becomes a Trishna from that level.
Right.
From the emptiness level, I would say, when you, those people who have understood it. But we have to see, we are in the scratch and we are gradually developing. It is development. It is never like going down. See, so in the first level, we need to generate that sort of passion to achieve the enlightenment. But that passion or wanting is not called Trishna from that level. So supposing a person who is very negative wanted to be positive, doesn't mean that want of positiveness is Trishna. Rather, wanting to be more negative or having more jealousy, hate or resentment, that could be Trishna, you know. So we have to check from the levels. So when we see from the enlightened point of view, of course that is a Trishna. But if we see from the initial level, it is not Trishna. That one thing doesn't become negative. That is a positive.
Right. It's almost like saying that there's wholesome desires.
Yes.
When you're at this level, like you say, to be more compassionate, to be more kind. Those
so,
are desires.
Yes.
But they're very wholesome, and we have to have those at this level.
Yes.
If we're
at
going
this
to
level.
Develop.
Yes. Yes. At this level.
Okay.
That's correct.
Good. Great explanation. Number 10. When you die, will you be reincarnated again?
It depends on my. Rebirth, definitely there will be, you know, because even you have cleared all the karmic debts, you know, even if you are enlightened, you are going to come and help the sentient being, there is no doubt. So the incarnation process is definitely there. But even though if you are not enlightened, you know, we tend to practice and make sure when we are alive, in our day-to-day practice, we tend to make sure with the prayers and with the visualization, with the feeling that we may come again. So in that basis, I think we would definitely come.
So you're saying even enlightened beings will be reincarnated again?
Yes, because... Okay,
but there's a catch here, because if that happens, and they're reborn back into this physical world with these physical bodies, mm-hmm. then they are subject to the laws of a physical body and the pains and the decay and the suffering that go mm-hmm. along with it, which is no longer an enlightened being.
They take a form. Their form decays. They have suffering. I would not say suffering. They would have disease, but they would not have the suffering, because the suffering is the mind's play, and they have overcome the suffering. Let's say, if I lost my car, if I bang my car, an unenlightened person, non-enlightened, if I bang my car, I would suffer, because it gives a pain, you know, I may think about the insurance and so on.
Right.
But if an enlightened person bangs, he would not suffer. If I bang badly, I may go to hospital, broken arm, but I will think a lot, you know. It has a lot of things to do when it is banged, or when something is happening, constructive or destructive. Our mind tends to be overexcited or frustrated. That part is not there. So because of that part is not there, they are enlightened. Not that the enlightened person, when it takes a form, will not decay, will not have cancer, will not go through asthma. It's not like that.
But that would mean then that there have to be people walking around this earth right now today who are enlightened,
yes,
that have been reincarnated,
yes,
and feel no physical pains.
Yes, that is. And they realize that they are not the body. They are more like soul conscious. They don't think this body is I. But most of us, we tend to think this body is I. The attitude of how we deal in the day-to-day life, you know, if someone hits you, we would not say, oh, he hit my body. He would say, he hit me, you know, the attitude. But then those who are enlightened, he hit my body, and I'm not the body. So the attitude is totally different. It's so subtle. It's a play of a conscious mind, how you take that in your day-to-day life, you know. But apparent is the same, you know, like when it appears, it's same, you know. Enlightened person, if you shoot, he will die. Non-enlightened person, if you shoot, the blood comes out and he will die. So appearance may be very similar, but how they take the things differs from enlightened and non-enlightened.
Okay. With so many, this is number 11, with so many religions, paths in this world, do you think that they all have the equal potential to reach nirvana?
Yeah, I think so.
So it doesn't matter, Muslim, Christian, Jewish?
Definitely not.
Doesn't matter.
Definitely not.
There?
Because all of them, they are talking about self-recognition. And when they come to a point, they say like, they have this to recognize yourself and recognize the God or the Creator, whatever the name they give, you know. But we tend to believe something like the Buddha would be inside us. And if we understand, try to go deeper in the Buddhism when it comes to the Vajrayana, we talk about the clear light, clear consciousness, which even the Hindu text talks about the clear consciousness, the pure consciousness. Even the Jesus would express that it's a clear light sort of things, you know. And even in Muslims, they have Nur Ilahi. Nur Ilahi means some sort of light, you know, the pure consciousness. So one or the other way, they are always talking about that clear consciousness, you know. And of course, like in our Buddhism practice, we have many, many ways, you know, many, many ways to achieve that. But that doesn't mean that we are superior or any others are inferior. Only the methods we provide is more. But the ultimate goal, I think we all have the same goal.
Okay. Number 12, how would you instruct someone if they are not sure of which tradition or school of Buddhism they should follow or study?
Because we have to
Somebody deal, came to you and said, I'm interested in Buddhism, but should I study Theravada? Should I study Mahayana? What should I do? How would you tell them?
Yeah, because of the, we have to check the mentality of the people. If, and of course, even like in the Buddhism, if you are practicing, you cannot just jump on the Vajrayana or Mahayana, because you have to start from the Hinayana level, the Theravada level, and then gradually improve to Mahayana and then to the Vajrayana. So one, there are very exceptional case, one in a million or two in a million can just go because their karmic connection and a lot of things, you know, the merits are so strong that they can practice and consume the practice of Mahayana or Vajrayana. But it is mentioned by Buddha and also another lot of great Indian saints that it is better to practice gradually. So the most important thing is we need to take the gradual step in Buddhism. As well as, like, let's say if there is a mixture of a lot of students together who follow different religion, who have the different mental disposition, then I think we have to talk from the psychological point of view. Then it makes a sense to everyone, because psychologically, emotionally, we are all the same. It is no difference between the religious person or non-religious people, believers or non-believers, Buddhists or Christian, it doesn't matter.
So it sounds like then, if I understand you, if you were just saying in general to people, like people that are reading this,
yes,
that want to know which path should I study or investigate,
mm-hmm.
It sounds like you would say in general Theravada is the way to start.
Yes, let's say like if the Buddhism, if one wants to like become a Buddhism, of course the Theravada should be the foundation. Without that, it cannot.
Number 13, do you have a favorite sutra? And I wrote down all the Sanskrit versions because I'm used to Sutta,
yes,
and Tanha.
Yes.
So do you have a favorite sutra, and if so, why is it your favorite?
I like the Heart Sutra because it doesn't beat about the bush. It
right.
just keeps the core teachings.
Heart Sutra, okay. And that's core teachings?
Yeah.
And that's different than the Diamond Sutra, right?
Dorje Chöpa, Diamond Cutting Sutra is different. But both of them are like Mahayana Sutra. But I like more than the Diamond Cutting because this is very concise and then to the point, you know. So that's very easy to understand. Whereas like the Diamond Cutting Sutra is really elaborated version, and then you have to like give a lot of time, and then a lot of like time is consumed, and contemplation is needed. Whereas the Heart Sutra, because it is heart, it's the most important, the core teaching of Mahayana Buddhists. And after the understanding of this, you understand the emptiness as a whole, and where a person can get fully enlightened, can turn into the Buddhahood.
Okay.
So I think this is the best sutra I've ever done.
All right, good. Thank you. And then one I thought of, I didn't write it down, but thought of this when I was meditating this morning, and that is, if you knew you were going to die today, in the next
yes.
15 minutes,
yes.
and I said, this is your chance to leave a message
mm-hmm.
to everyone. This is your last moments to say, what message would you want to give to the world?
The message of silence. I would just do the meditation and die, and people could see from how I die, with the frustration, anxiety, or with a calm mind, and that shows the art of living and art of dying both. And that is something what I would say is action speaks more than words.
So you wouldn't say anything, you would be
No, if it is 15 example. Minutes, it's a waste of time saying, you know, like, yes, of course.
Okay. All right. Very good.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.